With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, Matthew here with another rerun for you. My interview with the architect, Andrew Clancy. In addition to co-directing the practice Clancy Moore, Andrew is a professor of architecture at the Kingston School of Art, where I also teach, and where we recorded our conversation back in December of 2019. Conversation is, for Clancy, a valuable part of both his teaching and his practice. He actually started a podcast at Kingston called Register, which features interviews with architects who've visited the school. And as you'll hear, Andrew is a consummate speaker who really deftly elaborates on what it means to teach and practice architecture today. Clancy Moore will be giving a talk in March as part of the Architecture on Stage series at the Barbican Center, where they'll be talking through their work, including the Atkos building in Somerset, which recently was nominated for the EU MIES Award. This is an in-person event, so if you want to get tickets, go on over to architecturefoundation.org.uk to book yours. All right, so I'll be back again soon with new episodes, but for now, I hope you enjoy this 2019 conversation with Andrew Clancy. What I'm most curious about is understanding exactly what you're doing here.
Yeah.
And by here I mean at the Kingston School of Art, playing a part in directing the architecture program and I guess to a certain extent the curriculum as well.
Yeah.
And what you're doing as an educator.
Yeah.
Who is also an architect.
Yeah.
And I think if we just start kind of in the middle, in the thick of that question, is this, like, how many years have you been leading the architecture program?
So I don't lead. I'm the professor. And it's a kind of curious thing, which is in Europe, the professor would be, there'd be multiple professors in a university or in a school. And in Ireland, in the UK, for whatever reason, there tends to be just one or two. And I suppose it gives you, it's a different role. So in a school like Kingston, you're part of the philosophic leadership. And as a professor, your job is to sort of speak for and speak to the school. But also, I suppose, what's quite interesting about a professor is that you're not a line manager, you're not part of any hierarchy, you have no budgetary control. You have no ability to hire or to fire. So you're only as valuable as people find you, which I find quite compelling. So in a way, you have to be a couple of things for a school to be healthy. You have to be a mudguard, protecting it from certain things. And then you have to be a kind of an irrigation system, in a way. Just talking to students, making time for people. Also, seeking out people who might be insecure. It tends to be some of the better people tend to undervalue themselves. So a lot of what you try and do is foster relationships where they might maybe come to teach, and that might be good for the discourse. So you lead simply by allowing people to be themselves and then making sure that the people in the building are aware that they're valuable to an extent, as much as you can. And then making sure that you're keeping an eye on what the ethos of the school is. And I came here because I really respected the ethos of the place, which was a school that understood that, of course, there's all kinds of amazing depth of thinking in architecture, but ultimately it's reposed in a built artifact. And this school is very much about that. And that's quite unusual in a UK context. And so I applied for the job because I wanted to be part of a conversation, which is that I didn't think I was going to get the job, and I just wanted to make sure that at least I'd put my hand up, and that if the culture that had been here eventually got damaged because a different person took the job or something, at least I didn't sit to one side. And then I got offered the job, which was very surprising and really lovely. And basically since then, it's been a conversation. The school's gone through a lot of change. We've moved location. We've had a lot of new people join the team, etc. And you've just become part of the evolving place now. I mean, I'm not really answering your question because you want to know about pedagogy and what my beliefs are about how you educate.
We'll get there, though.
Yeah.
But what I'm curious about, I guess in response to what you've just said, is what to you was the pre-existing culture of the school? Because it sounds like you were coming in with the intention of fostering and tending to that as opposed to changing course or radically upheaving and redirecting things.
Yeah, a colleague said that to me 18 months after I'd started work. He said, when are you going to start making the big changes? And I said, name one person who's in the job that they were doing when I started. Mm. And there was nobody. Everybody's found new positions. Everybody's grown and changed. Some people have left, some people have joined. I don't believe in the etch-a-sketch version where people come in and tear things up. I'm a contextualist as a practitioner. I believe in understanding the social contexts where I work. I value them above all else. A school is a social and physical context. You change it by being present. And it needed to change, but not radically. It needed to grow and be its... I suppose people also needed to find a new version of where they wanted to go. Some people didn't seem to be getting their fullest expression of their abilities. And as an outsider at the time, I could see that. And others, I suppose, were moving on from the place. And that's just a school. The school's always changing. It's an organism. And I just wanted to be part of that. And also to remind the school of what it was great at. You know, one of the things that is interesting about places that do things well is they tend to undervalue themselves. So I'm very skeptical of the brands, the educational brands of architecture, the big name schools, especially the schools that keep telling you that they're a big name school. Because I don't think that is where you get the sensitivity of insight that you're going to get powerful work from. It seems to be all the places I found compelling architecture have been humble places, places that naturally have sort of undervalued themselves, and the students tend to be part of that. So also part of what I've been doing here is just reminding people why I get on a plane away from my family every week, because that's not easy, but you come here because it's great. What's here is great. And that's sort of part of the job too. And part of that then is to not be the figurehead, do you know? Because that's also stifling. You're just a voice among many, and if that voice has currency, brilliant. And if it doesn't, or if people disagree with you, that's also useful. But at least you're there to allow things to happen. You're a catalyst, I suppose. Do you know what I mean? And that with you not there, or a different person in the job, those things would catalyze differently, if that makes sense. Mm. And I guess that's quite analogous to practice, because I think practice is a negotiation, and it's not some kind of high and mighty command and control thing. I know it looks that way. I know education sometimes looks that way. But that's really nonsense. Do you know what I mean? So that's sort of a link. For me, they're sort of the same thing. I mean, it's different communities I'm speaking to when I'm speaking to practice and I'm speaking to an academic institution like this. But I like it because it's sort of very native with how I act, which is, yeah, I like a good conversation. And the nature of a conversation is you don't know where it's going to go.
Mm. That's exactly what thrills me about conversation as well. First of all, the urgency of the spoken word,
mm.
and that one word after the next, you still have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, you're right. Like the context for conversation changes between the world of academia and the world of practice, which they're often, for different reasons, quite divided. And what I was hoping we could get into was how you bridge that gap as a practitioner, as a director of your own practice, along with Colin Moore, and as someone who has a hand in leading the direction of the architecture faculty here.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you've taught for a long time now.
20 years, yeah.
At a range of different schools.
Yeah.
And participating in the world of ideas in architecture seems like it's always been crucial to you and Colin.
Yeah, really important.
And so for you, is teaching and being involved with the school a part of just kind of satisfying that, or how else do you instrumentalize teaching back to practice?
So that's a really big question and a really important question. So our practice started with this conversation, and we didn't even articulate it this way at the time. At the time, we were just trying to figure things out, but we always worked, we always made drawings, and we always, when we worked well, and there were times that we didn't work well together because we were just working out how we would work together, it was about finding things in each other's work that the other person had underestimated and hadn't even seen. And that sort of became a method. And it was funny, years later I read Gadamer, and he had this amazing thing, which is that if you want to have a conversation about something, you should devalue the thing that you place on the table. I'm paraphrasing, but he basically says, here's an idea, and what you would say if you want to have a conversation about this is, here's everything that's problematic about that idea. And that allows the other person to empathetically find things. Go, well, actually, no, look at it this way, it's interesting. Whereas if you put an idea on the table and say, this is amazing, this is the best idea, well, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no onwardness from there. You're immediately setting an oppositional kind of argument, right? And I guess that became the method of the practice, and it became the method of the teaching. And then, of course, the practice that we set up in 2007-ish, you know, a year afterwards, Ireland went into the deepest depression, I think, apart from the Greek crisis in recent European history that lasted for 7 years. And, of course, then the practice couldn't have survived without teaching. Queens in Belfast came looking for us, hired us, they were heading up a new program. I was running a course, incredibly young, and then that opened further doors to us, and other things followed, like a visiting professorship to Aarhus and others, and people seemed to value what we were doing. And so the educational thing also became a way that we met people, that the profile of the practice and the ideas in the practice became known, because we're not good at PR and we're not polemicists and we're not self-promoters, we're not that type of people. I don't devalue those things, it's just not naturally how we act. So teaching also became a way that the practice grew and found space. And I think that those two things sort of are intrinsically linked. And then what I really enjoy about that is that we've always kind of empathetically sought to share that experience with our students. We've always been very open and quite confessional about that, because I remember being in college and just being so confused by the edifice of architecture. It looked so perfect. And these people that we were admiring seemed so incredibly talented and erudite and impossibly so. And how could one ever be? And it didn't seem to be that the journey by which they had become that was understandable. Do you know what I mean? Like, these buildings were amazing, and the thinking behind them was amazing, and the books that we were reading and the lectures that we saw. And the whole thing seemed incredibly scary. And actually then, what we find is that it's a little bit different to that. It's like a walk or something, do you know what I mean? And actually there's stumbles and there's messes and there's successes that you don't understand at the time, and there's all that kind of stuff. And it's life, it's the stuff of life. And so we love sharing that with our students as well. And of course, a student will never judge you for those things. They're just super eager, do you know? They don't care that you messed up and you're telling them about a mistake you made. They don't think any less of you. In fact, they probably think a little bit more of you, maybe. So I like that kind of openness. It's a very, talking to students is a very supportive place. Mm. So it's a good conversation both sides of the table. And fundamentally, that's why I like it, teaching, I mean. Mm-hmm. Kingston, yeah, is a different place again. I'm just thinking of that because the conversation here is different, because there's an urgency and there's a kind of a plurality and a diversity of conversation here that isn't available in the places that I've taught before. And I find that really challenging, that really interesting. And how do we respond to that?
So there's a few points in there I kind of want to touch on now.
Yeah.
But the first, I guess, is the approach you take to seeing things.
Yeah.
And how the act of seeing for you has this kind of inherently redemptive aspect to it. I could be wrong on that, but you're kind of looking a bit dubious.
Don't know about redemptive, but go on. I'd like to know what you think.
Okay, so you were teaching at Queen's University at one point, and out of the studios came these kind of pocketbooks.
Yeah.
One of which was called Stair Rooms.
Yeah.
The other that I found was called The Elaborated Window.
Yeah.
And for the latter, you and Colm had written an introduction.
Yeah.
A brief introduction, kind of framing the interests of the studio. And you mentioned at one point the art critic Lawrence Wechsler.
Yeah.
In a book he'd written called Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees.
Yeah.
Which is about, it's like a biography of this Californian artist named Robert Irwin.
Yeah.
And now when I saw that, I kind of lit up because I love Lawrence Wechsler.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
He's amazing. He's an art critic who finds unconventional ways of recognizing correlations between things that you would otherwise assume were totally unrelated. And it's a kind of criticism that I find very positive. And maybe that's why I said redemptive.
Now I understand why you say that. Yeah. I remember reading that book and just a whole load of lights going on. That, I mean, I knew Robert Irwin's work in the later period, the architectural pieces, and they were part of this perfected world of that I didn't understand. And then here's this critic that shows you how he goes from making marks on canvas and critically thinking about those marks and evolving to elaborate wall works to sculptural forms that are almost invisible, to becoming background, becoming architecture, and eventually becoming a gardener. And what he does so incredibly is that the stylistic variation, which would be superficially the important thing to a critic, to him is the symptom of a singular line of inquiry. And that really was compelling. And particularly when we were looking at work that was so different to the work that we were interested in. Like, you know, you come out of a context and there's work that you're trained to think is, in, you know, in inverted commas, good, and other work that's in inverted commas, bad. And you sort of understand the shape of those arguments, but it tends to be grounded in style, or at least it was. And we understood immediately, we started to practice, because you could do whatever you wanted to do. There was no rules, there was nothing. You could literally do whatever you wanted. So it was a personal ethical position that you had to form. So therefore, the style was irrelevant. The only thing that was important was how you engaged with the question, and what the question was. And it seemed to us that the moments that were transformative, and to use your word, redemptive, of situations, were where somehow in the mess, you find a way of seeing things that before you hadn't seen before, and that became the foothold or the thing that took the project forward. And that works with teaching too. And those books that we made were, I mean, they were really important for the practice, and it was a long time before Kohlhaas did his Elements of Architecture, and we would disagree completely with how he had looked at the elements of architecture. We took what we call spatial curtilages, which were elements, sure, like stairs and windows, but we sought to examine them in their spatial and cultural curtilage, and we made models. Or the students were just given a situation, and they were said, you need to make a model sufficient to describe the spatial curtilage of this archetype and situate that archetype. And then we'd have this room of 50 of these things, beautifully modeled, beautifully photographed, and you didn't know when they were made. The dates were not present, that was not there, but they would describe what the events happened in that space and what happened in it and how people moved through it. And it was just a day where everything was possible. History was present and the future was present, and it was all architecture and it was all seeing. And what we found amazing was the excitement with which students would talk about and the urgency with which they would engage with those work. It wasn't Rorschach anymore. It was just how that curve, you know, might remind them of something in this kind of side space of Borromini, because the Borromini model is just over there. And suddenly we found a way that history kind of collapsed into a present tense sensibility that students could then navigate. And what was really interesting in that was that we found ways that we could tease out the students' own ethical position, because you saw how they intuitively were looking at things. And so you began to go, isn't that interesting? You see that way. You see this as collage, whereas your colleague over here, she sees this as synthesis. And both of your positions are correct, but in that observation, in that dissonance, there's also a conversation about how you two might practice differently to one another and legitimately pursue the sincerity of those questions. So those exercises that we did in Queens were really formative, and they came straight out of talking about the critical text on Irwin and how that text helped us see Irwin and then by empathy see ourselves and see the world of architecture. Architecturally, you're trained to see things a certain way, necessarily, and the truth is always more nuanced and more compromised and more ambiguous.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a frustration here with the prescription or the format for thinking about and talking about architecture.
Yes.
And a frustration with, I think, the aversion people have to taking risks and seeing things differently or finding value in what is not necessarily a consensus viewpoint on a building or an architect or whatever.
Yeah.
And in that way, I guess, like, you're interested in vulnerability.
Yeah.
Which comes through a lot in the interview project that you coordinate, the Register podcast.
Yeah.
Which is almost in a way identical to what I'm doing with Scaffold, except it's cited at the university and tied to a lecture series.
Yeah.
And involves multiple interviewers. But there's a interest in biography and the context of practice and the context of building and design that you don't often get when someone stands up to speak about their work.
And you can't, when you stand up to speak, tell the people about the fort near where you grew up. The format doesn't work for it. You know, you change as a person when you stand in front of a room of people. And yeah, so that interview project started, it's a nice way of describing it, just because very quickly when I came to Kingston, I realized so many of our students were from non-conventional backgrounds in architecture, which is wonderful. It's what made the school so great. And that meant most of them had to travel big distances, like 2 hours. And they didn't have huge amounts of resources, and most of them had second jobs. And so all the playtime I had of just sitting in the library and pulling random bullshit off shelves and thinking it was wonderful and then finding that it wasn't, isn't available. That free, unprogrammed, non-productive time is not available to students today in the way that it was when I did it. And so we just said, well, let's just record a chat with the people who come to the school and put it out. The easiest way to connect with our students was podcasts, because it was free to do it, and the university systems didn't allow you to work off-site, and they needed, anyway, it doesn't matter. So it was just a way of getting the students who couldn't go to the lectures to have a connection with these people. And then it started to get some legs, and then we started to go, actually, it was a way of giving a voice to this place, that everybody knew Kingston was a great school, but nobody really knew what they talked about here. And a bit like those books in Queens, where the argument to the students was, you put that book on the table of anybody you want to work with, and the chances are they'll give you a job. The podcast and the books that are about to come out and other things that are coming out from the school under the Register imprint is a way of activating the voice of the school. And it is a voice concerned with vulnerability, and it is a voice concerned with marginal voices. And understanding that there's a canon in architecture, and understanding that we have to add to that, and we have to look at it in different ways, and we have to be aware of different cultural backgrounds as we augment that, but there's a heartbeat of architecture that's serious and rigorous that we're continually adding to as we change our perspectives on the world. But that ultimately at the heart of it, if you don't see the vulnerability in the work, and if you can't make an empathetic connection with something, even something as perfect as the Parthenon, then there's no in for you. Do you know what I mean? I'm really interested in people wearing architecture. Do you know what I mean? That it's not something it's not this thing on the table over there, that they're, even from the very start, they're comfortable with the discourse of architecture, that there's nothing that they're scared to say, that they don't mind putting up their hand at the end of the lecture and saying, why did you express the beams and the whatever, or anything. And I think there's a lot of things that happen in architecture, and I don't know why, to do with a fear where certain people don't say certain things. They don't say the blindingly obvious often. I mean, there's a joke in architecture conversations about the lecture question, like the obtuse, complex question. So complex, and I love those questions only because in it I see mapped the insecurity of the questioner. So desperate to hide the obvious question, with a portrayal of their intelligence, and you go, don't worry, I've never met a stupid architect. So we're all intelligent. So you can ask it really dumbly. You can ask why the wall is green. You know, you can ask, you know, you can ask those questions. Sometimes they're the only question. And I think that that's part of it, and I think it's a nice observation that it is vulnerability, because that sort of is cited in a text that I wrote about typology called The Casual Buttress, which was a really kind of, you know, in Ireland we complain a lot about a lot of things, but there's this amazing body called the Arts Council, and they give money to artists, but they also give sometimes money to architects, young architects, to help them support their careers at critical times, and Clancy Moore wouldn't exist without the Arts Council. We got a couple of grants of, you know, several thousand euros. And one of them was this thing called the Kevin Kieran Awards, which just let you go off and just look at things, think about things, and make a project about it.
Maybe we should try to unpack that essay, The Casual Buttress, as a way of maybe framing an interest that you'd established early on in your kind of critical career,
yeah,
that is carried through to your practice and teaching today.
Yeah.
So what is The Casual Buttress?
Casual Buttress is an essay that I made like under this Arts Council grant, and it was in relation to a photo I found in an archive in the Museum of Country Life in Mayo, and it came after several months of going through many archives. And it's a photograph by an architect called Robin Walker, taken as a student in 1943 during World War II, and he was looking at cottages in Ireland as part of formal studies, I think at the end of his first year or second year. And it's just in this bundle of papers of plans of cottages. And basically, I was drawn to the photograph only out of desperation of having found nothing. I'd gone through these archives looking for a tectonic reasoning into architecture. We'd just finished a house in the quarry which was based on traditional Irish stave architecture, and the pitch to the Arts Council was, we found a language in prehistoric stave architecture through archaeological remains that has liberated this building for us. I'm going to go through more archives and find out more tectonic insights that can change us. And I thought I was looking for terribly practical things like rammed earth construction and, you know, bog oak as roof rafters, whatever. Anyway, I wasn't finding those things. And I just found this photograph, and I just noticed that down the bottom Robin had scribbled his name, and I just took a picture of the photograph just for no other reason than there was a connection between me and an architect I'd never met but who I'd admired, and that he'd taken this picture. And I just sat and started, I said, I'm going to write an essay about it. And like, what's quite interesting with me is, you know, it's like you said earlier on, stuff just falls out of your mouth. And I was critting with Tom Dupuyre in Queens the next week, and he said, how are you getting on with the Kevin Kieran thing? And I said, you know, I'm really not getting anywhere. I'm putting loads of work in, but I'm not finding anything. But I think I'm going to write this essay about a buttress. And it was the first time I said buttress. And he said, oh, what's the buttress like? And I said, well, it's casual. And I just was doing it to be pithy. But the name came. And then I sat down with that photograph the next weekend, and I started to write about the buttress that was casual. And I only said casual because they were off center on the gable. But I began to then tell the story about how I'd seen the photograph. And what I saw was a cottage. And then I saw that there had two buttresses in front of it. And I was trained to see the cottage first because of typology and architecture and the form of it. And the buttresses were additions in my view. And then I looked at more and more cottages, and I knew them from my childhood everywhere. They all have buttresses. And I realized it's kind of strange that they all have buttresses, but that doesn't appear in the type drawings. Because the type drawings are, you make hundreds of surveys of found vernacular types, and then you make a perfected type, which you call the type. And that isn't a real thing. It's a prototype of all the found conditions in the field. It's quite a strange thing to do, but we do it in architecture a lot. And actually, in this examination, I said, well, if it's about commonalities to a building form, the buttress is common to most. Why isn't it in the type? And it's not in the type because it's changed its location on every building. And it changed its location because the site is different. The ground fails in different ways, or the roof fails in particular ways, or the earth doesn't bind together appropriately. And I saw in this amazing moment where type, which is to do with universal knowledge and things which can be kind of formally exchanged in that kind of abstract way, was then being connected intrinsically to site via a different thing, this buttress. And so the casual buttress is a metaphor for the relationship between, I suppose, purity and context. And what I say is that if the cottage speaks about a society and speaks about exchanges of knowledge to do with how a family might live and what the proper way to do things are and what society says you should do, the buttress is about the individual act of care or maintenance and the specific person who lived there and their story. And actually, in a moment, you can see a buttress and a cottage and you can make an empathetic connection with the point where the buttress was added, the point where the wall started to go. Maybe it even happened during construction and there's a decision to add a buttress. Mm. And that felt like a way into architecture for me in a very deep way, which is that here we can talk about the history of architecture and we can engage with a huge wealth of reference bases as we do in Clancy Moore, and we love it. But we can also talk about the specifics of our clients and the specifics of our builders and the nature of when a beam fails. And actually it speaks about things which are open and garrulous and not scared of inflection, and that you can put your finger into an idea and it stays the same. The type of the cottage isn't broken by the buttress. In fact, the brittle type drawings of the cottage meant that that so-called vernacular architecture became unusable, because it made a building, it said that all the architectural knowledge present in this cottage is in its shape, three-room cottage, whatever. And of course, society moves on. We can't make three-room cottages anymore. Society doesn't live that way anymore. But actually, the buttress talks about a different thing, which is to do with the connection between site and these imported types. And actually, that's a much more usable thing. It's not literally usable. It's metaphorically useful, that you're always looking for this. And I suppose it's why things like the vernacular became very difficult for architecture to absorb. And that's why architecture, as it grows, the things it's allowed to look at, always adds these kind of prefixes, which is terrible, you know, like vernacular or socially engaged or look, whatever, like all architecture is socially engaged. I know there's more or less variations of that, but I don't like those prefixes. I always reject them. I think architecture is architecture, and it's what you find in it. And in that moment, I found something that has allowed me to see, you know, the work of Bernini anew, and to see the work of Shinohara anew, and to see the work of Kahn anew, like in this looking at something terribly prosaic and ordinary.
Now where I want to go is to the formation of Clancy Moore.
Yeah.
And I guess, in a way, the practice is still young.
Yeah, I know. And I'm 42, Matthew, and I'm apparently still young. Yeah.
But I guess we're all still in this process of formation.
Yeah.
And you mentioned figures like Shinohara.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, writers do this as much as architects. We quote, or we reference, or we kind of make ourselves in the image of our idols to try it on for size. You were talking about wearing architecture.
Yeah.
And I want to understand a bit about who you were trying on and who you're trying on now in order to understand what kind of architecture you and Colm are making.
Okay, let's start with the chronology there, right? Which is start practice. And we had some very odd jobs. We had jobs that had been rejected by a couple of different architects, or which had been told to the clients were impossible to do. One was a house in a quarry where nobody had got permission in that valley for 40 years, and another one was this church that needed a new porch, and they only had 10,000 euros or something like that, and the best idea that an architect had offered them had been a curtain or something, you know, just ridiculous things. And we started with the high things, like, for the church, we were really compelled by something David Ajay had done, and we were looking at that, but it proved far too expensive. And with the quarry, we were really compelled by something that Ruini Shuaza had done. I don't know why some of his work is given his own name and some is Sana, but it was a project that he'd done on his own. And that was also impossible. And both of those projects were exercises in us going through our understanding of
what we were fascinated by in finding that it was far too brittle for the contingencies of where we needed to work. And what happened with both those projects is the same person, a boat builder, offered us an economic way to make buildings that were robust and cheap, but had to be made in ways that were not of our thinking. He was basically sitting down with us and going, look, you know, if you're going to do it, you should really do it this way, and you need to think this way about it. And so suddenly there's this other voice in the room, and then the architecture just became what it became in a really weird way. And it was quite scary, actually. Like the with the church, we were mocking it up on site because it could only be made in certain spans, and this form evolved. It was quite a bombastic form. We weren't sure about it. We thought it would be recessive, but it looked quite dramatic on plan. We were very worried about it, so we were netting it up on site with string, and we found that we'd all of the dimensions wrong because we'd done them through orthographic projection, not compensating for perspective. So we'd respected the cornice lines of the church. We needed to break those for it to sit in. All the standard learnings, but the abstracted knowledge of architecture wouldn't allow you to make those adjustments. And with the quarry, it was the same. I mean, our clients would laugh about it. The number of times was us up there with blue rope and just going, this is, how high is it? Like, that high? Really? Is it that high? And constantly trying to understand what these things were. And, you know, there was a point even, the plan evolved because of a planning constraint and a light constraint. And we never showed that plan to anybody for a few years because we were embarrassed about it. It looked like an X. So it looked like we were some kind of graphic architects from Denmark or something. And we weren't. We were interested in something else. But it ended up that way through a lot of contingencies to do with repetition, the type of timber-to-timber joints that our CAD-CAM router was able to make, all this kind of stuff that you don't need to be aware of or worry about. And so we had these two buildings, and they were not at all alike. And they were not at all like something that we understood. And that was not by design. It was by just getting through the thicket of it. And we'd started out by trying things out. And then when they were starting to come together, they were moving in particular ways, and we started to adopt, like, the interior of the quarry was supposed to be like the Wittgenstein house. It was supposed to be super abstract. So we got on board with this kind of heavily textural timber wrought work on the outside. The inside was supposed to be really pure, and of course the timber was moving hugely because it was a very difficult site, so the timber was soaking up a lot of water and it was all moving, so we had to do linings and skirtings and architraves, and then we started to put all those together, and we were really getting into that, and we were looking at work by others, like obviously Florian Beigel and others that we were looking at that gave us permission to think this way, and some early work by Dior DH, that, you know, just things that we were examining. And we began to find figuration in those things, and that became a really powerful moment. And yeah, then a couple of things happened which were really interesting. The first was that people liked those buildings, and we were started to get clients who were encouraging us to do things like those buildings. And then the recession came and killed all that work, it just all died. And then the second thing happened was that Ellis Woodman came over to write about the quarry about a year after, maybe more after it had been finished. And he wrote this essay, and in it, at the end, he just says that he could see that there was a desire towards purity in a lot of our other projects, this unbuilt work that he'd seen. Like, there was these very pure plan types, highly, highly refined, classically derived modernist forms, quite analogous to certain types of autonomous Swiss architecture. And he was saying it's interesting that in their body of thinking, this project's an anomaly because it seems to be to do with the kind of command of multiple contingencies as opposed to the search for purity that the other work shows. And it's probably an anomaly in their work, but it deserves to be considered a compelling one. And it was an interesting one because what he said was so incredibly true and truthful. I think we need to...
Oh, really? Is there a class happening here? What time?
Yeah, I think we need to stop.
Oh, okay.
I'm so sorry.
No, here, I'm just going to stop that.
We can resume it, but I don't know. Eleanor is just looking in the wall. And the
all right.
No, it's good.
Oh, we're good. Okay.
Sorry, man.
No problem.
I'm just panicking because...
Yeah, yeah. I guess we should try and
finish up now anyway.
Soon, yeah.
Anyway, he just said this thing to do with multiple contingencies, and we found in that a truth which was quite challenging. And then another thing happened which is worth saying is that we started to do this PhD by practice a few years later, and at the time we'd been invited to give lectures in Switzerland about the work and this kind of thing, And we were telling the story as you would tell the story of architecture in a lecture. And it all felt so incredibly pat. You know, you've got 30 minutes to explain a project that took years to do, and you make this truth, it is a truth, but it's so edited that it looks like you were in command of the process, even though the presentation was one to do with finding this thing.
Uh-huh.
And we realized that, well, we didn't quite realize it, but when we made those lectures, we realized that it was forcing us back into a kind of idea about purity, because you could describe it in half an hour and make it clear to yourself and to another person how it happened, that there was a chance that we would get caught again in this style. It was just a different style to where we'd started from. Mm. And then with the PhD by practice, we found a kind of reflective technique which allowed us to actually realize, no, the style is just how it turned out. And how it turned out was appropriate to the site, and it was the result of a sensibility which we discovered by accident, like two people basically clinging together in this mess, because we were out of our depth, you know, we were doing our best. It turned out really well, technically, but the technical side of that job was an incredible learning experience for us.
Mm.
And how it turned out isn't the practice, because we didn't know that at the start, but the journey was, and that was why we did it. And that technique now means that who are we wearing? Who are we looking at now? Who are we not? Like, you know, people who work in the office will laugh, like we're continually pulling books off shelves. We look at everybody from Marais. At the moment, I'm just thinking of a small house. Essentially, we're looking at Marais a lot. We're looking at Rivas, Portalupi. We're looking at like some really beautiful early houses by Gehry, Caesars, those early projects, very like. So we sort of use each project in a way to help us tell the story of architecture to ourselves and to our clients. The briefs that we get are terribly ordinary things, and they're things which are probably the biggest investment that person's going to make, like their house extension or whatever. And, you know, it's €150,000 or whatever it is, a huge amount of money. And so it's not our business to force them into a box. One of the things we found with this technique is that we're not scared of them changing the design at all. And we're very confessional with the clients about what's happening. And if they say things, even at the moment where they say it to us, we might reject it initially, it goes around in the office and we always find that there's a truth in what they're saying. Like, definitely they were spot on about a lot of things. And so they become kind of not, it's a complicated thing. We like this technique because it seems to allow us to navigate our situation.
Mm.
Okay,
so just as an aside, how much more time do you have?
I have another 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, questions I want to touch on are kind of Irishness.
Yeah.
In terms of your affiliations to the country you grew up in and what it means to be an Irish architect practicing both there and teaching abroad. And another thing I want to talk about at some point is the PhD
practice.
By practice program and why you decided to do that and what kind of value that has for you and how that's changed the way you practice.
The PhD by practice happened because this guy called Leon van Schaick came up to Queens to meet a couple of the professors, and we knew nothing about it. And at the end of the day, Michael McGarry, who was the professor, just said to Leon, don't take the train, get a lift with Colm and Andrew. I mean, he was putting something in motion.
Yeah.
And so we drove Leon from Belfast to Dublin, 2 hours, and we stopped off on the way at a kind of an early medieval monastery, and we talked about architecture. And by the end of it, he'd convinced us to go over to Ghent to this PhD by practice seminar, where we made a 20-minute presentation. And we had a conversation for 40 minutes with the audience and with them, and they basically were unpicking the work, not critically, not negatively, but critically as in the point of sharpness.
Mm.
And, you know, we were just hooked by that. And it produced a thing where we could talk about our work jointly in these forums every 6 months, or occasionally Colin would present separately to me, and we would get to see and hear each other present. So you got space to hear each other say things that were perhaps harder to say face-to-face or in different situations.
Sounds very therapeutic.
Yeah, like creativity necessarily, like it's not anything to be anyway complicated about it is. It's like creativity, I think, necessarily comes with frustrations, and it crosses over into emotional worlds. And that side of it is essential, I think, if you're going to have a long-term working relationship and a friendship with people that makes things. But then also, and the reason we did it wasn't for the therapeutics aspects of it, it was to do with actually making the ground of the practice more explicit to ourselves. And the ground that we basically established was one of conversation and figures. The conversation exists to hold multiple divergent thoughts in play all the time, in a way that a drawing or a model can't, because you need to resolve them to have them manifest beautifully in those things. And then, so we've got lots of drawings and models, and then the conversation binds those unlike things together. And then what we look for is these things we call figures, which are moments where, in those contradictions, there's a congruence and something becomes apparently necessary. So, classic one in the Portobello warehouses, they didn't have big floor to ceiling heights. We couldn't change the exterior because of all these other issues. We had to insulate it, so we poured the new screed on top of the old floor. So the floor had to be super thin, which meant it had a tiny span, super small span. But we knew we wanted to make these kind of quite monumental spaces just for the clarity of the thing. And so all the columns and the stairs ended up being having to do the job and having to be where they were because of these contradictions. And then combined with those were questions of the clients to do with wanting open plan, wanting privacy, and so the figures, these columns and things, became elements which we could divide and link spaces together, a choreographed thing. And so that's the big thing about the PhD, was that those kind of techniques, which is that's a very simple project, but it allowed us to do that game, which is a budget and tectonic game and a structural game and all the technical things, and it deals with regulation and fire laws and all that stuff, and allows us to talk about the history of architecture. So you can play with Michelangelo over here, or you can talk about Venturi, or you can talk about whatever. You know, it doesn't matter. But the point about it is they become the means by which references matter to us, because they allow us to connect with deep lineages of thinking. They've done all the hard work for you to make that discovery, and then you go, that really, really allows us to think about this in this way. So in this armature, the figures are the place where all of those things cohere. Mm. And they are literally sometimes figurative. Mm. And then the Irishness thing, sorry, we've probably gone on too long, but the Irishness thing is an interesting question, because I don't know. Like, my family would have a deep history in, say, Irish nationalism, like back in the War of Independence and the land war. Effectively, like, my mother is right now in New York because she's been researching her grandfather, which would have been the Sinn Féin envoy to New York during the War of Independence, and he would have raised all the money that was funding the war and all that kind of stuff. So we have a deep history in the nature of Irish nationalism, an understanding of it, but we're not nationalists in that sense. Like, my parents were very involved in the peace process, and they would have always made the point that the idea of a united Ireland, for instance, is a colonial concept. Only the British saw it as one island, because if you're a conquering force, of course, it's a single place. But of course, to Irish people before that, it had been multiple kingdoms. And it's much more natural to think about Ireland as multiple identities within one island. And so in that, there was a kind of conversation about plurality within the country. And so I've never really understood Irishness in the sense of national territorial identity, and I'm skeptical about the nation state, and I watch what's happening here in Britain with interest, is all I say. I find it interesting what's happening here. And so there's that side of being Irish, which is, it always felt like being a place to be connected to somewhere else, that Ireland got its valency through its conversations elsewhere, and that there was a type of conversation possible in Ireland which was different, but not better or worse, a different way of looking at things. And so the conversation was always one to do with that exchange. Ironically, I didn't get to go on a plane until I was in college and to see these other places, but that was the conversation. And in truth, that's how we see it in architecture, which is that there is no Irish style, and I don't really think that there is an Irish tectonic, but there is a space for a particular type of plural conversation in Ireland, one that uses multiple engagements with the history of architecture that comes from our slightly marginal location. And I was having a debate with Shelley McNamara about this, and she goes, Andrew, we're not peripheral. And I said, oh, I felt peripheral growing up. You know, I don't know. Maybe we're not. You don't feel it. I feel it. But what it did do is you were terribly curious as a student, because you were going, well, we're not from anywhere that matters. And over there is where matters. And actually over there seems to matter too, and over there. And so you were constantly just voraciously reading and looking at everything, with really not knowing what you were looking for. But what it does mean is that you tend to find a huge reference base in Irish practice, and one that's not generally, now I know all the names I've mentioned are quite orthodox figures, but there's not, they don't easily package into the boxes that they're put in elsewhere. And that's what I sort of think might be of use and of interest to the world at the moment, which is that those references are being driven out with some rigor in different ways by different people, and it's allowing architects to act with territorial intent, with great sincerity, and with no attempt for cynicism or anything like that. It's a pure thing. Like, it's a kind of a sincere, naive kind of belief in architecture and in the discipline as having something to say about a particular place and a particular group of people, and also having a legitimate reading of its own autonomy as a discipline. And all those things are not, they don't contradict one another if you do it right. And so there is something there about being an Irish architect at the moment which is pleasurable, because I think that as the world moves to being one where people do more and more work in fabric and less monument, and there's more and more contingencies, and we're more aware of the plurality of the world, that kind of curiosity and that sincerity is useful right now. The Irishness that I value in that really is this thing to do with turning the idea over, and a slight irreverence as you do it, that the answers aren't what you expect. And it's not about portraying how knowledgeable you are, how intelligent you are. It's just about whether the conversation is worth having. Is it pleasurable? And what's nice about that is that you find, you know, anybody who comes to the country, it is not an Irish thing at all. What's quite nice about it, I think, is that a lot of our friends, like, they weren't born in Ireland, they're Irish now. But it's a conversation that's super easy to learn once you've realized that's how you do it. Oh, it's okay to just say this and to look at it this way and then to make work like this. So I also like it because it feels open. Now, whether the country of Ireland is open or not is a different question. I think we've got lots of deep-seated problems that we need to resolve. But culturally, at its heart, I find it's curious before it's judgmental. It's irreverent before it's ponderous. And it's scholarly. And I like that. And I don't think that's unique to Ireland. But it's what I associate with Ireland right now in my discipline. And it's probably what I enjoy most about it.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Matthew. That was good fun.
So that was my 2019 interview with Andrew Clancy. Congrats to him and Colin Moore on their EU Mies Award nomination. And a reminder that if you want to see Clancy Moore speak in person at the Barbican Center next month, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk for more information. Thanks as always to Scandalin, and thanks to you for listening. I'll be back again soon with new episodes.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.